So it is Buddhist tradition to always start a talk on Dhamma with paying homage to the Buddha. So I start with that. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. So today I would like to give a talk on the Abhidhamma. Actually, this talk is meant to be kind of an explanatory talk on a book that I wrote some time ago called Paramatta, and it is basically an introduction to that book. So the reason for writing this book is, although the Abhidhamma is taught to be the higher Dhamma and the advanced teaching of Buddhism, actually there's a lot of confusion and suffering around the whole issue of the Abhidhamma. So probably most Western monks or most Western Buddhists, they don't really think it's the Buddha's teaching. But even in very traditional Buddhist countries, of course, people adopt the official opinion, the official way of dealing with it, the official way of thinking about it. They try. But actually also in traditional Buddhist countries, there's a lot of confusion that the Asians, including Burmese, Abhidhamma is very strong in the country of Myanmar. Even there you find that there's much confusion as to whether there's any benefit for meditation practice or what it is for, what is the meaning of it. There are a lot of books, like the traditional Abhidhamma Pitaka is many volumes of books which will take a very long time to study, and then there are various Abhidhamma manuals which were sort of summarizing the Abhidhamma. But there's very little understanding of a practical value. Even the great teachers, meditation teachers, especially in Burma, they will always try to relate meditation practice to the Abhidhamma, or usually they will. But it's very often very artificial, and it's obvious that there's tension surrounding the whole issue. So seeing this as a major condition in Buddhism, having interest, having some karma along the line of metaphysics, metaphysical thought, along the line of understanding thinking systems, I had motivation to try hard to see if I can make something out of the Abhidhamma that is more inspiring than what you usually find, and more useful. So that is a main idea of why I wrote this book. But the book is not a purely scholastic treatment. It's about the practical value of it. So at some places, I have quite different interpretations of various Abhidhamma items. But the idea of any such system, as I understood it, the main important thing to get about it is that it's a system which is meant to show a path from material existence to spiritual consciousness. So it's showing a natural sequence of how we can use mindfulness skillfully together with meditation in a manner that we can come to an understanding and direct experience of anything that is important and of value for a spiritual minded person. So it's not anymore believing texts, it's about finding a way of understanding our own reality, our own experience in relation to a system, and by that combination learning to turn our experience into knowledge, which will have the effect, if it's properly done, that it modifies our consciousness. It modifies how we perceive reality. We want to change ourselves. Part of the practice of meditation, why people start meditating, why people are interested in meditation, is because people want to change themselves. They hear that there's a possibility of becoming much better a person, much more perfect a person, much wiser a person, much more loving a person, much more patient a person, and so on. So that is why people usually have an interest in meditation, and if they're not born in a Buddhist country, that's why they're usually inclined, why they have interest in studying Buddhism. Because Buddhism is always thought to be, at least in the West, the originator of meditation. Like there may be also various meditation, Hindu meditations and so on, one hears about, but Buddhism is more famous for, as a founder became enlightened, and it is well known throughout the world that Buddhism is a religion which is all about becoming enlightened oneself. So the idea of this book is to give a method to make out of the Abhidhamma, which is very scattered information, like difficult to connect information. I try to connect the information. I try to show how the information relates to each other. So meditation, many people understand, is about mind, studying the mind, developing the mind. But as I will show, without any understanding of the body, with its sense organs and with its internal processes, one cannot really get a comprehensive understanding of the mind. So I start the book with a treatment on matter. So this is one of the basic ideas of this writing, is without understanding the body, one cannot get a comprehensive understanding of the mind. Without an understanding of the mind, one cannot get a comprehensive understanding of karma, of virtue, of vice, of knowledge, of vision, of samsara and nirvana. So along these lines, I try to show how one can meditate along such lines, how to gain some understanding of the body, how to gain some understanding of the mind, and then building up further how to gain, based on this understanding, get a grounded understanding of karma, which is not somewhere in the sky, but each step is meant to build up on the previous step. So this is what is the basic idea of the first part of the book, to show these basic ideas. Then the second part of the book is trying to show the patana. The patana is the most abstruse teaching of the Abhidhamma. It's the most difficult to comprehend what it is about. If we read it in the main books, it is very difficult to understand what its purpose is and what possible use it can have. and the meaning of the statements that are written in the Patana books. So, just as a brief explanation for this short introduction, there are 24 Patana conditions, and they are meant to show different possible relations between those ideas we will treat in the first part. So they are meant to show different relations between matter, mind, and consciousness, revealing patterns in perceived reality, which could be proven or which may be perceived when carefully observing matter, mind, and consciousness. Or expressed differently, they are a method which, if applied to matter, mind, and consciousness, can infinitely expand the understanding of these. That is, it can infinitely expand a person's knowledge after he acquired the basic understanding. And in fact, they are meant to expand the knowledge of matter, mind, and consciousness to such an extent that they are able to explain the entirety of existence. They can be compared to operations in mathematics, where one can compare the basic ideas of matter, mind, and consciousness as being similar to the numbers 0 to 9 in mathematics, while the Patana conditions will be something like operations as plus, minus, multiplication, and division. And from there we can see already that much more can be done with these numbers, as much more can be done with matter, mind, and consciousness, or with the ideas of matter, mind, and consciousness by means of the Patana conditions. Many more things become understandable or explainable. And that is the purpose of the Patana, to understand or to explain reality, to understand or explain conscious experience to the full. Now, in the book, I went even further than that. Putting together what can be done with the Patana conditions under the heading of the five Buddhist laws of existence, the five niyama, which are another Abhidhamma idea. But in this talk, I will not go that far. So, having given that much of an introduction, let's begin by exploring what matter is. So, what is matter? Usually, if we were asked like that, we think it's quite obvious what matter is. No? We point somewhere, or we knock on the table, or on the floor, and that matter is that which is, for common purposes, probably good enough. But if we learn to think more intelligently about what is matter, then, as I will show later, we can do something with matter. We can do much more with matter than if you wouldn't know anything more elaborate as to what is matter. So, most ancient systems divided matter into four primary elements. That is, earth, water, fire, and wind. And this scheme, this division of all matter into these four primary elements, in Pali called Mahabhuta, the great elements, this will be very helpful for the person who wants to develop his mind,
or wants to understand his body in order to develop his mind.
But then how should we make a start in classifying our experience in line with the four elements? Well, usually we would start in designating everything what we experience as solid, as weight,
and as texture, as belonging to the earth element. Everything we are experiencing as liquid, as clearness, or as depth, we would classify as belonging to the water element. Then all forms of heat, of radiation, and of light are taken as expressions of the fire element. Well, fluctuation, movement, and anything that is subtle, we would classify as pertaining to the wind or air element. But then, where should we start making these distinctions? Where should we find material to classify this, to classify matter? So for the meditator, it will usually be through the five sense faculties that he will start making those distinctions, that he will make a start in developing his understanding of matter. So, but then each sense organ has its peculiarities. So the organ of the eye sense, we usually have two different considerations. I can perceive colors, and I can perceive forms. So there we would start applying this classification scheme as to sharpen our mind to make distinctions in regards to matter. So just for showing how that would work, we would try to understand what would be earthy forms, what would be watery forms, what would be fiery forms, and what would be airy forms. So earthy forms will be everything which looks heavy, which looks coarse, which looks concrete, which looks bulky. Then fiery forms would be objects which glow or radiate light. Then watery forms we can distinguish by certain translucency or clearness and by some depth of the appearance. And then airy forms will be everything which appears subtle. Then the same thing can be done regarding colors. And so there, earthy colors are things like brown, black, or gray. Fiery colors are red, orange, and yellow. Watery colors will be deep blue and green. And colors relating to the air element would be the color of white and light blue. And that can be done with every sense organ. So we receive odors through the nose. So there would be also earthy odors, such as what smells heavy, suffocating, or coarse, smoky. Then there are odors that are of a fiery kind, which are sharp or stinging, or somewhat perceived as burning. Then there are odors of a watery kind, odors which have some characteristics of moistness, of clarity and depth, and so on. And then odors of airy type would be what smells fresh and pure and subtle. The same thing can be done with flavors. So we receive flavors through the tongue, and they're earthy flavors, whatever tastes a little bit heavy, nutty, salty, coarse, or peppery. That will be earthy flavors. The fiery flavors is whatever tastes spicy, or which has a biting flavor, like bitter or sour, that are fiery flavors. Then there are flavors of a watery kind, such as whatever easily flows down, like sweetness. What has this quality of wateriness to it? And then there are flavors of an airy kind, to which belongs basically whatever tastes rather plain or is rather tasteless, but also whatever is kind of perceived as a subtle flavor. Then as the same thing can be done with sounds. So we receive sounds through the ear, and they're earthy sounds, whatever is very loud, whatever sounds kind of heavy, whatever sounds coarse, that are sounds belonging to the earth element. Then there are sounds which are fiery, such as what is forceful, what is glorious. That are sounds of a fiery kind. And then there are sounds that are of a watery kind, such as what sounds very clear, or sounds which have some quality of depth to them that belongs to the water element. And then whatever sounds swift, whatever sounds fast, but also whatever sounds subtle belongs under the air element. And for the last sense, we also have earthy tangibles, such as whatever feels solid, hard, or heavy. We have tangibles of a fiery kind, that whatever feels hot, or what produces pain, or whatever feels sort of sharp. Then tangibles of a watery kind is what feels liquid, or what is experienced as possessing a certain depth to it. And in last, the tangibles of an airy kind is whatever is experienced as movement or fluctuation or as subtleness. And through that we can see that all our experience, or at least all our sense experiences, can be put into this classification scheme. Taking it even further, we can also see that each of these sense experiences is conveyed through a certain medium. So the main medium for the conveyance of forms and colors to the eye is the element of light, an element which belongs to the fire element. Then the main medium for conveying taste to the tongue is the element of water. The main medium for both conveying smells to the nose and sounds to the ears is the element of air. And in regard to touch, it is the earth element, which is the main medium for the conveyance of the sense of touch. So we can see that all sense experience can be fitted into this scheme. But then, as our sense experience very often is not entirely agreeable to us, what becomes then important as a second task in regard to the four elements is to not just be able to distinguish these four elements, but to learn to balance them out against each other. For that, we can sometimes see that there are usually that each element sort of has a certain counter element. So there are two elements which are rather coarse and solid, as earth and water. And there are two elements which are rather insubstantial, as the element of fire and the element and the air element. And such understanding can be used to balance them out against each other. So if we have an excess, we experience an excess of coarseness of earth element in our experience, be it the physical experience of how our body feels, or experiences related to any of the senses. If we are in a small room that perhaps also is very dark, that might be a quite disagreeable condition for us. So even lighting up a lamp, putting in some fire element, would make already a little bit a balance to the situation, or would bring a balance to the situation. If everything around ourselves or within ourselves is fastly moving, we might feel disturbed by that, so we would try to find some way of grounding ourselves, some way of bringing in the earth element into our sense experience. Or if we would perceive either within ourselves or surrounding us an excess of the fire element, then we would try to balance that out, for example with the water element, or at times with the wind element. And if we then ever come to an experience wherein all of the elements are well balanced out against each other, then we can get an understanding of what life is. Then we can get a direct experience of what life means, of what the element of life is, or in more traditional terms, what the faculty of life is. So in matters of the four elements, we will find that the life element is a form of matter which possesses the solidity of the earth element. It possesses the subtlety or subtleness and the movement of the air element. It possesses the energy of the fire element, and it possesses the clarity or clearness of the water element. And these will be harmonized to a degree of great balance. Now, this life element is on a quite new level, on a quite different level compared to that matter. That matter, what we treated under our consideration of the four elements, was for the most part a rather static phenomenon. But life is not just a static phenomenon. Life is rather a process which gravitates around a certain center. So when we have the first experience of this life element, usually it will gravitate around our digestive process. That is usually the first place where we can perceive it. So we perceive it where the body transforms food into energy, and there this sense of aliveness we start to perceive. But gradually, as we learn, especially if we keep observing this life where we perceive it first, then gradually it will move higher. So we become interested in it, and suddenly we become aware that the life starts revolving more around the heart. And if we keep observing this, then slowly it will move higher into the brain. So we begin to perceive life processes in the brain. And as we study these life processes, then we find that the Abhidhamma classification of different types of matter can be very useful for studying what we perceive. So according to Abhidhamma, there are four different kinds of matter expressed in terms of what originates the matter. So we have the first type of matter that is mentioned is usually translated as temperature-born matter, but it may be also translated as nature-born matter or caloric matter. This is a matter which is originated from without. So we slowly have to get used to also this conception of things of in matters of how they're perceived by consciousness, in matters of how they're moving into the space of consciousness. So this first kind of matter is matter that is originated entirely from without the personal experience. This then gets transformed into matter which gives energy or nutriment to the body. So this is usually translated as nutriment-born matter. Further, we have mind-born matter, matter that arises based on states of mind. Usually we will, in modern times, we would call it, we would see the equivalent in the hormones of modern science. And the last category of matter is karma-born matter, matter born of karma. So most of what we take to be our own body comes into that category. You know, what gets born from the mother's womb is matter born of karma. Our bones, our flesh, our skin, belongs to matter born of karma. So if we memorize these four types of matter, and with that knowledge, with that theoretical knowledge, we try to observe what is happening inside our body, then we have some better way of making sense of what is happening. We have some words to describe to ourselves what we perceive. So usually we will gradually learn to perceive how our body is transforming physical food, nature-born food, or temperature-born food into nutriment, and how this nutriment then slowly spreads through the whole of the body. And it spreads via certain karma-born matter. It spreads through the network of the blood vessels, and it feeds the various internal organs. So we might find that the heart, which is also matter born of karma, is the pump of our body. So this form of karma-born matter, this heart, it pumps this nutriment-rich blood through the whole of our body. And with that, the different organs are getting supported. And each organ getting nutriment, getting energy, it suddenly becomes capable of fulfilling its respective function. That is, each organ has its own function. We can say the organ is born of karma, and the function is born of karma. It is due to certain karma from the past that these organs came about to manifest a certain type of karma. So when the heart is pumping blood to the lungs start to breathe. When the heart is pumping blood to the arm moves. Or when the heart is pumping blood to the head, then the jaw moves, or the whole head moves, etc. But then certain organs possess certain functions which are rather related to an interaction with the outer world. So the sense organs become receptive to an outer world.
And this in turn will trigger other processes.
So here we have to learn that that life element
that we have been talking about before
possesses two primary impulses. One is to be attracted to whatever supports it, and the other is to repel away from whatever threatens it. So when the senses receive impressions which promise some support for the life within, then another form of matter is triggered into existence, and that is matter born of mind. So when there is received through the senses a certain object which is somewhat attractive, then within there arises mind-born matter related to desire. And when this mind-born matter related to desire has arisen, it equally enters the bloodstream and gets pumped around by the heart. So if that blood get pumped into the legs begin to move towards the attractive object. When that blood gets pumped to the arm stretches out to take the attractive object or picks up the attractive object. This is maybe the most basic form of mind-originated action. But alternatively to this mind-born outer action, there is also the possibility to a mind-born inner action. So when there's a sufficient amount of this nutriment supporting the brain, being pumped into the brain by the heart, then instead of this dynamic of mental impulses generating outer actions, or sense impressions triggering mental impulses which trigger outer actions, we can rather have a dynamic of sense impressions becoming processed in the brain. That is, sense impressions are getting investigated, are getting designated, and are getting memorized and related to previously memorized sense impressions. And based on that, a certain idea is evolved of the outer world. So there we can already see a certain hierarchical development, where we start off with physiological processes, then you have desire, and then you have mind states which are gradually more higher, that are of a higher nature, like interest. And if we are studying our own experience together with some Abhidhamma learning, then we will see there's a certain relation to the treatment on the mental process that the Abhidhamma is giving. So I'm giving a slightly untraditional interpretation of that. So in the Abhidhamma, there are different parts to the mental process. The mind can be treated as a process, as a mental process, which consists of different parts. The first of these parts is usually called the stream of Bhavanga. And the word Bhavanga means that wherein one's existence is rooted. It's usually translated as a life continuum. So that is the first part
the stream of the life continuum.
This is the condition of the mind, especially in deep, dreamless sleep. Out of this entirely unconscious stream of Bhavanga, there become manifest deep inclinations from the past. This is called the past Bhavanga. When some of these gathers a little bit in strength, gathers a little bit in life, then we call that the vibrating Bhavanga, the vibrating life continuum. This manifests in dreams, this manifests in desires, and this manifests in emotions. It basically manifests in what we might call semi-conscious processes of the mind. But then, as there arises greater consciousness of mind, that consciousness will, so to say, take greater hold of the body and of the senses. And as it does that, in order to advert to some object of the senses, first these unconscious and semi-conscious processes will be arrested. Only in this way, consciousness can, so to say, become fully conscious. It becomes fully conscious by adverting its attention, adverting to some sense object. That is a certain power of the conscious mind. So adverting to the senses gives that consciousness greater objectiveness, a greater objectivity, or a greater reality. Due to that, those outer objects are getting received into the mind. And having been received into the mind, the conscious mind starts working with them. It starts to investigate what it received. And having investigated what it received, it gives a designation to it. So the consciousness becomes sharper on the object. And then it declares, this is this. And with that, it has evolved a concept, a name concept of that thing that it designated. And once that conscious mind evolved a name concept of a certain thing, it acquired a means to think about that thing. So once a conscious mind acquired various name concepts, manifold name concepts, it develops a stock of name concepts. And as it acquired a stock of name concepts, it can relate those various name concepts to each other, and through that evolve a meaning concept. So as a mind acquired more and more words to describe to itself what it is that it perceives, it combines those words of the aspects of what it perceives into one concept of the meaning of what it perceives. So it declares, this has such color, this has such form, this has such smell, and later this has such behavior, into one meaning concept of this is such and such a thing. This is an animal. This is a bird. This is a source of food. This is a threat. So the mind will slowly also acquire a stock of meaning concepts. So as a mind acquired a certain amount of concepts with their meaning, it starts to develop a certain relationship with them, or it starts to develop a certain relationship with some and not with others. So in order to make this distinction as to what to take into itself and what not, the mind starts dividing those concepts into good and bad. And as the mind acquires this conception of good and bad, it naturally becomes intent on the good, on whatever it declared as good, while by nature it will not be intent on the bad. This being consistently intent on something is what is called karma.
But how does that karma work?
We intend in a certain way, we intend in a certain direction, and that intention modifies consciousness, modifies the working of consciousness, modifies the working of future consciousness. We intend to have a certain thing, and that intention to have a certain thing will modify our consciousness to see opportunities for getting that. We are hungry and we intend to eat an apple. So that intention will lead our consciousness to see the fruit store. Or we are walking through a park and that past intention to have an apple makes consciousness perceive, makes consciousness aware of the apples on the apple trees. If there would have been no such intention, that consciousness would not have been aware of these. And if it does not perceive the apple without, it might perceive images of the apple within. And it might remember where in the past it did acquire apples, where in the past it has found apples. And this then initiates in turn certain actions of the body. So if we start understanding this dynamic of our experiences conditioning our thinking and how our thinking modifies our consciousness, modifies what we perceive, then that will give us a certain clue regarding the nature of conscious experience itself. And it may give us a certain clue regarding the possibilities regarding conscious experience. Because it gives us a certain clue that the limitations in our experience, the limitations in our experiences of life really lie only in the mind and the concepts of the mind. Which basically means we could create a heaven for ourselves. We could create a heavenly experience. We could make our life a heavenly experience. But equally, we can make it a hell. We can make our life experience, our experience of life, a hell. And that might make us realize that corresponding to the heaven and hell without, that everyone has heard about, there's a condition of consciousness within, and that that condition of consciousness depends on our thinking, as our thinking depends on our capacity to transform sense impressions into concepts. But then, having established that much about consciousness, one may wonder as to whether then consciousness is the highest reality, and whether a self-made heaven is the highest thing to be gained. One thing we have to remember when trying to answer this question is that consciousness is always involved with some experience, with something without, with something it is conscious of. So whenever some outer object arises, whenever there arises something without to be experienced. Then consciousness is born. And usually whenever that object disappears or that experience has come to an end, usually then the consciousness will die. From that we can understand that certainly a consciousness which works in this way cannot be the highest reality. So in order to get closer to coming to an answer to that question, we might want to dig deeper into the nature of conscious experience. A being is born into the human world, and once that being agreed to that existence, the nature of the consciousness will ever be peculiar or particular to the human world. So that being, as it grows up, becomes ever more identified with being a human being. So the consciousness is a very particular human consciousness throughout a normal human life. Now, that consciousness is something slightly different from what arises in response to some object or experience and dies when the object or experience perishes. But although it is something different, it will enter always into that equation. So each person sees things in his own way, depending on his past inclinations. Now, when without there arise experiences which are somehow in agreement with our past inclinations, then that deeper consciousness, what usually is referred as a rebirth consciousness, will be able to manifest to a greater extent and for a longer duration. But then, we're in the sense sphere world, even for the person of great wealth and support, the conditions inevitably change. So what was in accord with his deeper inclinations inevitably be replaced by things that will be rather in discord with his inner inclination. That is just the nature of the sensory world. So well, for a person which is native in the sensory world, consciousness inevitably perish. But then, as a human being, either initiated from without or initiated from within, comes into contact with subtler aspects of life, acquires knowledge of subtler things, knowledge of things that are invisible to the senses. It begins to cultivate the perception thereof. It begins to look for the subtle. It begins to look for what is invisible to the senses. And as it deliberately begins to look for whatever it acquired knowledge of, it begins to expand. It begins to expand into another world. And thus, it begins to perceive more things, because it then not only perceives the things of the senses, but also the subtler things.
So, based on its knowledge of the subtle, consciousness begins to expand in extent and duration. Having established then that knowledge is a key, we might want to go on in working out what sort of knowledge could prevent consciousness from dying altogether. So the Buddha gave out various pieces of knowledge which he promised can give the deathless. One very central set of knowledge he repeatedly gave was the five parts of a being, the five khandhas, which I now already have treated to some degree. These five parts of a being matter, rupa in Pali, vedana, feeling, perception, sanya, sankhara, which is usually translated as formations, but is often taken to be quite equivalent with kamma. And the last part being consciousness, vijnana. I do not want to go now further into them, because I think what has been said before can already throw enough light onto the subject for our purpose of giving only an overview. Another set of knowledge the Buddha repeatedly gave was the chain of becoming, or what is usually translated as the law of dependent origination. For an explanation on that, I would refer the listener rather to my book, because it is a subject which has been treated reasonably well in many books. So for now, I would rather go on to the patana conditions, because it's a subject which is not very well treated, not very well exposed. So the patana conditions are another key of knowledge, another set of key knowledge, which may help us to get closer to the deathless. The patana is a method which, together with the previous items, together with the previous ideas of mind, matter, and consciousness, is meant to give a means to comprehend the entirety of existence. So, in this system, each of the ideas of mind, matter, and consciousness is treated under the heading of each of the patana conditions. There are 24 patana conditions, and each of them shows a way to think of mind, matter, and consciousness in a manner that will reveal a different aspect of reality. But maybe first, as a disclaimer and prior statement to begin with, what I'm going to say about the patana conditions is not likely to give a student in Buddhist studies in a university good marks. So most treatments I've come across until now about the patana conditions were quite meaningless, were quite absurd. And the specific
statements made about each of the patana conditions seem to contradict the general statement about the patana. The general statement about the patana being meant to explain existence, being the highest teaching of Buddhism. So here I just want to offer an, as far as I'm aware of, new interpretation of the meaning of the patana conditions. So I translated most of the patana conditions also quite differently from how they are usually translated. But I do believe that the translations I gave come into the limit of the Pali word. The Pali word can be translated in various ways. So I tried to find designations or translations which are more productive of meaning. So in the traditional statements made about the patana, there are at least three sets of patana conditions which are said to only differ in the word, while the meaning of both will be the same. So there are three sets, six patana conditions, of which the translation given to one is just a synonym for the opposite of the pair. So to do away with these strange explanations, I gave different words to each of those patana conditions, different words with different meanings. So in this talk, I just want to explain two patana conditions, just to show how the method of analyzing things into mind, matter, and consciousness can be applied to each of the patana conditions. Now, as my own discernment of the patana conditions, as my own contemplation of the patana conditions is not yet finished, I only for the purpose of showing how it can be done want to give here two examples so that the student of Abhidhamma might get some clue of how he himself could contemplate, how he himself could think of the patana conditions. First, I want to show how to consider about matter, mind, and consciousness under the condition of meditation in Pali called jhana paccaya, or expressed differently, how the knowledge of matter, mind, and consciousness can give us some clues as to how to meditate. Now, in order to comprehend any of the patana conditions, we might best systematically run through our previous scheme, but with each consideration ask ourselves what each of the previous statements on matter, mind, and consciousness can tell us about whatever patana condition we want to consider. So, as we are now trying to comprehend the patana condition of jhana, we will first start off with considering about matter, and most specifically with considering about the four elements, and there ask ourselves how they relate to meditation. So we might begin with asking, what can the element of earth teach us about how to meditate? Now, we declared earth to have as main characteristics weight and solidity. So when meditating and considering about the earth element, we might slowly discover that in order to make our meditation a success, we need to develop a certain sense of groundedness. Plus, we too want distinctness of experience. And just that very simple consideration will give us a model then as to how to proceed with the other elements. So we would try to consider in a similar manner about the element of water. We do not want wetness in meditation, nor do we want to have too much of an experience of liquidity. What we want in regards to the element of water is depth of experience. And depth will in meditation specifically mean that body and mind become a unified, singular thing. So we may declare water to stand in meditation for unity, which for our consideration of just showing how the method works, that is good enough. So then we have the fire element. The fire element possesses various positive qualities, such as light and energy, but also has a characteristic that it can burn things, which, when considering in meditation, may make us realize that brightness and energy are important in meditation. While we may also conclude that in order to succeed in meditation, we might need also that power to burn away what is in the way. Last but not least, we have the air element, standing for subtleness, standing for purity, but equally standing also for movement. All qualities which we might find should not be lacking in successful meditation. Although the last quality of movement may often rather just mean that we should be on the lookout to have no stagnations arise in meditation. Now, that treatment, brief as it is, should make it clear that even a simple understanding of the elements may already be a good help for the meditator who seeks to understand how to meditate. Further, we had as a second consideration about matter a description of the life element. We were talking about that when the four elements have become balanced, that there comes about this experience of life. And there comes about this consideration of a higher form of matter, a higher form of matter than the four elements. So there again, we would try to consider what will that mean under the condition of meditation. Well, maybe in the first place, it may give us a certain clue that health is important to get somewhere in meditation. Health is the experience of life. So this is an important element to consider in relation to meditation. Now, physical health has as one major cause a wise driving of the body, a wise usage of the body. But then, for a wise driving of the body, or for a wise usage of the body, a certain amount of understanding of the physiological processes of the body is quite necessary. From which we can see that the various statements regarding the functioning of the body that we made earlier on are a preliminary understanding for how to meditate. In fact, the initial and sustained awareness of the physiological processes of the body constitute what are called the first two jhana factors. which will then naturally lead us to a consideration of the mind. So the initial and sustained application of consciousness are the beginning of the meditative mind. We have before talked about that in the sense sphere world, the mind adverts to the objects of the senses. And based on that, thinks about the objects of the senses. And through that, further creates ideas of the objects of the senses. And the same thing happens in meditation too. But there, the mind adverts to the world within, thinks about what it experiences, and then creates ideas of the meaning of what it perceives. But in meditation, the idea to lead somewhere has to be felt. Only when it is felt can consciousness remain for longer within, can consciousness be sustained within. Now, the meaning of a sustained consciousness is that consciousness expands, is that consciousness becomes a larger consciousness, a larger than a mere momentary consciousness. And as that consciousness begins to expand for some prolonged period of time, then interest arises, joy arises, which will be the third factor of meditation, the third jhana factor. And when this interest begins to arise in meditation, and when this joy begins to arise in meditation, usually various nimittas arise, various signs that show that the mind is getting concentrated, that show that the mind is getting unified. If then the mind, based on that interest, based on that enthusiasm, has more and more periods arising of a joyful, heightened awareness, then that becomes the fourth factor of meditation, the fourth jhana factor. And as that becomes more and more established, the mind will become more and more one-pointed. The mind will become more and more concentrated. Now, in the beginning of the meditative development, usually these experiences will break again and again, and the mind will need to re-establish awareness again and again. Only gradually, these factors become more and more stabilized, and application and even sustainment will slowly be abandoned, while each of the higher factors gradually will be made perfect. Now, alongside with the breaking of awareness, the meditator usually will have to deal with various mental hindrances. These generally will arise from accumulations of past karma. They manifest as emotions, as desires, as aversions, and so on. Things which we declared to be manifestations of the vibrating bhavanga. So, usually depending on what obstruction arises, depending on what hindrance arises, the meditator will try to consider certain Dhamma ideas that are, so to say, counterbalancing these obstructions. So what, for example, a meditator who would encounter mind states of laziness seek to overcome them by, for example, reflecting on death, by reflecting that death is inevitable and that he should try hard to accomplish something before death arises. And similar things will apply for other obstructions. For example, the condition of hatred will be counterbalanced by a certain consideration of
benevolence of unconditional love and such thoughts. While, for example, a condition of sexual desire might be overcome by reflections on the repulsiveness of the physical body. So the mind will usually start off on the path of meditative development by considering about various spiritual ideas, various Dhamma ideas. But these are therefore, for the most part, only to counterbalance certain obstructions. And when the obstruction has disappeared, then the meditator will usually rather pay attention to these jhana factors, which I have previously enumerated. Now, if we think back to our consideration of the physiological processes, then we can also trace where these jhana factors arise within the body. So we will find that the initial application of consciousness will usually be directed to the coarsest of physiological processes, be it the breath or be it the digestive process, where we will too gradually discover that sustainment of consciousness can actually only occur when we develop the ability to be aware of more than just one physiological process. And when we are able to accomplish that, then joy arises, then interest arises. And that will usually be perceived to arise within the heart. Then when that in turn becomes established, we will see that the whole process will gradually move towards the brain, and how when one-pointedness becomes accomplished and concentration becomes perfected, that this will occur in the brain. Maybe that much about the relation between body and mind. Then perhaps one final consideration in regards to this condition of jhana will be the nature of consciousness in relation to this condition. Now, meditation or jhana is about changing consciousness from a consciousness that pays attention to the material world to a consciousness that pays attention to a world of finer matter. A finer matter which is to some degree actually produced during the process of meditation. And that might give us perhaps a certain clue as to the cosmological side of this condition. Getting ourselves already into dangerous waters by taking modern cosmology as a reference, we might take a still greater risk by supposing that the experience of jhana cosmologically relates to the condition of the sun of our or any particular solar system. Because as the sun produces energy and light, that is finer matter, so does a meditator too produce energy and light. That is the material side of it. But from the perspective of consciousness, the condition of jhana is that of feeling energy or finer matter while learning to see and move in it. And as tradition asserts that the experience of jhana is a native dwelling condition of the god Brahma, we come into a position of knowing something about that divine being. Leaving with that the Patana condition of jhana, let's take as the further patana condition, the condition of analogy or correspondence, which is my translation of the Pali Anyamanya Paccaya. Now in the book, this is the condition I have explained first for one reason, that it can give us a very good key for the comprehension of many other things, including other patana conditions. So analogy or correspondence means that two or more phenomena possess similar characteristics, and due to that, understanding something about one of the phenomena allows one to get a clue of the corresponding phenomenon. The point of contact with the known allows for a certain exploration of the unknown. So for understanding something about this condition, we will try to comprehend matter, mind and consciousness in relation to this condition. Or, taken differently, we will try to further our understanding of matter, mind and consciousness by the use of this patana condition. So let's see how that would work. In the beginning, we declared matter either as that which possesses certain qualities that can be described by the scheme of the four elements, or we declared matter to be what the senses apprehend. So then, what would be matter under the heading of this condition of correspondence? The first correspondence one might find in regards to the four elements will be that there is a certain correspondence between the four elements or four properties of matter without, in nature, and within, that is, within the experience of the body. So whatever one understands about these four elements without may also apply to the four elements within, or vice versa. And this gives us the first basic clue as to how to apply this patana condition to matter. But then we elaborated in the beginning in the exploration on matter by showing that there also is a kind of living matter. And obviously, of course, what has been said about the four elements applies equally in that respect to this living matter, in that we may perceive living matter without, or we may perceive living matter within ourselves. But with each degree of complexity of the matter, one may also reach greater degrees of profundity with this method of the patana. So when we talked about living matter, we talked about the organs of the body and the various processes that arise based on those organs. So then, let us think, where can we find a correspondence between those inner physiological processes with what is perceivable without? Now, we started our exploration of the body's physiology with an explanation about how the body transforms physical food, or what we call nature-born matter, into nutriment. Now, without, a phenomenon not altogether different may be perceived, only on a slightly different scale. So if we learn to see the similarity between certain rudimentary physiological processes and the lower class of a society, we may see that as the stomach of the body has a duty to, so to say, harvest nutriment from nature-born matter, that is food,
So does a farmer or field worker harvest nutriment from the field of nature without. And along that line, we will find correspondences also to other physiological processes. So we talked about certain hormones in the body, which was what we called mind-born matter. And organs which transform nutriment into mind states of pleasure, refining the nutriment to become something subtler. And a very similar thing can be seen also without, in there being a certain correspondence to those householders whose work is to transform the coarse materials of bare nature or of a bare natural life into a variety of things for enjoyment and trade. Further, we can see that there are various organs and bodily parts whose duty it is to protect the whole body from danger. Either from dangers without, which might be threatening the body as a whole, or from the danger of harmful bacteria or viruses within. And in these we can see a certain correspondence to the police or army of a country. These then are in turn ruled over by the king or the ruler of a state, just as the lesser part of the brain rules over the, for the most part, unconscious processes of the body. And finally, there's a larger part of the brain, in modern times called the neocortex. Now, the duty of that bodily organ is to give meaning to the experience of the entity as a whole. And this then corresponds to the priest or philosopher whose duty it is to give meaning to life. Now, from that treatment, it may become obvious that the idea of paramatta, the idea of ultimate truth, must not necessarily mean some treatment of abstract ideas as particles of matter or mental processes, but rather the term ultimate truth may also refer to timeless truth, which is not distorted by relative ideas of changing conditions. But then let's go on to the mind. Let's see how this condition of correspondence can be applied to what we have said about the processes of the mind, the mental process. So when we were talking about the mind being a process of various parts, we found that these various parts are following quite a hierarchical sequence, wherein primitive mental processes or rudimentary forms of mentality gradually grow in life, gradually grow in strength, starting from a condition of utter unconsciousness, the condition of the stream of Bhavanga, gradually coming to greater life in the condition of dreams, growing still further to conditions of emotions, to further evolve into a condition of deliberate thinking up to the creation of ideas. And this again can be perceived on various levels. It can be perceived in many instances in life,
in many instances throughout each person's day. But it equally can be seen to correspond to the life on a grander scale, wherein a baby is born. A baby is born into the human world, mostly sleeping, rarely being awake, but slowly the mind of the baby grows to greater life. Slowly desires arise, slowly emotions arise, and gradually there begins a painstaking process of making sense of the things of the senses, of apprehending the mind to the things of the senses, and of evolving concepts about them. Now, in an ideal manner, in an ideal way, this process will usually grow more and more complex throughout the person's life, until the processes of the mind will have to give way again to the processes of nature, are dominated again by the processes of nature, until finally death sets in. But just as after each conscious thought a person has throughout his days, the mind moves into latency, but yet arises again with the next conscious thought, the mind may equally arise again after the last thought at the end of a human life. And thus we can see how the whole mystery of life may be unraveled by an insight into the processes of the mind when this condition of correspondence is intelligently applied to it. But then we have a still further consideration regarding the nature of the mind in relation to this patana condition. We have already before declared that there is a certain correspondence between the heaven and hell without the knowledge whereof has become part of human heritage, and the condition of the mind within. So we find that mind states of agony and deep suffering correspond to the hell without, while on the other hand side, mind states of joy, of freedom, or of happiness correspond to the world of heaven without. Further, it is a person of a cruel mind which corresponds to the demon declared to exist without, while it is a selfless person who thinks about the welfare of others which corresponds to the angel or heavenly being. So, with that, I will leave this condition of correspondence. I think this should serve as a sufficient example of this condition of correspondence. And I hope that much made it clear that along such lines, one might indeed come to a comprehension of the entirety of existence, which is a promise of the patana. Concluding, as I already stated, my own comprehension of the patana is still an ongoing project. I will leave this talk with only these two examples. I hope that perhaps in the future I will be able to give a follow-up talk about the rest of the patana conditions, but for now I would rather invite the listener try to apply the method for himself, to try to use what has been given for his own furthering of wisdom, for his own furthering of mental development.
And with that, I leave it.